Welcome back to Trackside Talks, everyone. Today, we're diving into a paper that might sound, well, a tad technical at first glance. It's called Relationship Between Track and Tunnel Central Lines, and it comes to us from Eric Wang, Sanaya Karawala, and Wilson Dai over at Mott MacDonald in Melbourne. But trust me, if you've ever found yourself on an underground train and, you know, just for a second wondered how they make sure everything fits down there without, like, a major mishap, well, this deep dive is going to take you behind the scenes of some seriously impressive engineering.
Definitely.
We're going to untangle this crucial relationship between a railway track and the tunnel that surrounds it. Imagine the track as a high-speed athlete needing every inch of space to perform at their best. And the tunnel was kind of like that athlete's carefully designed training facility. Our mission today is to figure out why getting that track perfectly positioned within the tunnel is so incredibly important and what factors the engineers need to juggle. And even how the latest tech is helping to make this whole mind-boggling process a little bit smoother.
Sound good.
Sounds good to me.
Let's get into it.
All right. The paper jumps right in, talking about the need for effectively space-proofing for assets within the tunnel. When you read that, what immediately pops into your mind as to why this is so crucial for an underground rail system?
Right.
I mean, seems pretty obvious, right? You got to fit the train in the tunnel. But is there more to it than that?
Well, yeah, you hit the nail on the head. It's definitely not just squeezing a train into a tube and calling it a day. This space proofing, it's about making sure there's enough room for a whole, like, interconnected web of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Think about it. You've got the track itself, of course, then the trains. And those trains, they don't just sit there all static. They move, they bounce, they sway a bit, and then layer on all the safety systems, the ventilation, the power lines, you know, all the behind the scenes stuff that keeps things running. Oh, and don't forget about future maintenance. Years down the line, someone's going to have to access all this. So the team at Mott MacDonald, they really drive home this point that how you allocate space at the beginning has these, like, ripple effects throughout the whole project life cycle.
Fascinating. So it's like a domino effect. You get one thing wrong and boom.
Kind of, yeah.
And speaking of domino effects, the paper also makes a point that this space proofing is a, quote, critical input for tunnel size optimization and has a major impact on project capital costs, end quote. So if we don't get this right from the get-go, we're not just talking about minor inconveniences here. This could get really expensive really fast, right?
You got it. If you connect this to the bigger picture, just imagine, and this has actually happened, you design a tunnel and it's too narrow. Now you got to fix it. And trying to rectify that after construction's already started or even finished, that's a nightmare. You're looking at massive cost overruns, delays that push back the opening of the line, and it could even, in some cases, compromise the safety and efficiency of the railway in the long run. The paper really positions this early space-proofing stage as, like, the bedrock, the foundation for the success of the whole project.
Wow, you don't get much more fundamental than that, do you?
Yep.
Okay, so the authors lay out several key considerations that directly impact where that tunnel central line ends up in relation to the track. Let's start with the most obvious one, the train itself. And they use this term, the kinematic envelope. Can you break that down for those of us who, you know, maybe don't have an engineering degree?
Sure. Think of the kinematic envelope, or KE for short, like an invisible bubble around a moving train. It's not just the static dimensions, you know, the height, width, length of the train cars. It takes into account all the movements that happen when a train's in motion, the bouncing, the swaying, even little shifts when it's going around a curve. And as the paper points out, this KE, this bubble, it's defined by tolerances in both the rolling stock itself and the track. Because in real life, you know, you're never going to have perfectly straight and level track. There's always some variation.
So even tiny variations in, say, the rail profile or the alignment,
yeah,
that can all contribute to this dynamic movement. And then on top of this kinematic envelope, we add another layer, the safety clearance margin. That sounds like a double safety net, right?
That's a good way to put it. That margin, usually around 100 to 200 millimeters, it's like an extra buffer zone. It takes care of anything unforeseen that might go beyond those standard tolerances. Like, maybe there is some unusual vehicle behavior in extreme conditions, or maybe there are slight inaccuracies during construction. This margin helps make sure the train doesn't accidentally bump into the tunnel structure or anything inside the tunnel. It's all about keeping things running safely.
I see. So it's like, you know, measure twice, cut once, but for trains.
Exactly.
Okay, so we've got the train itself, but then there's the track. The paper calls this the track form. Now, we're talking about two main types here. Ballast track, which is the more traditional kind, the one with the loose stones, and then ballastless track, which is more like a fixed slab of concrete. From a purely spatial point of view, what's the big difference that engineers need to consider?
Yeah, it all comes down to stability. Ballastless track, it's much more rigid by nature. It keeps its shape much better over time. So the kinematic envelope for a train running on that kind of track, it can be a bit tighter. We don't need as much wiggle room. But ballasted track, well, it's got a bit more potential for like movement and settling. So we have to design a bigger buffer into the whole system to accommodate those potential shifts.
It's just a trade-off, right? You have the initial cost, and then you have the long-term maintenance and spatial needs.
Right. So ballastless is more stable, but maybe more expensive to install initially.
You got it.
Okay. Next up, we have the overhead line equipment, which is just a fancy way of saying the system that powers the trains. Now, the paper mentions both rigid conductor bars and those more flexible wiring systems. How do those different approaches change things when we're talking about space within the tunnel? Well, each type has its own, let's say, special demands. Those rigid conductor bars, you usually see them in tighter spaces. They have very specific clearance needs, got to prevent any electrical arcing. Then you have the flexible overhead catenary systems, which give you more flexibility, literally. But those wires and their support structure, they need a certain amount of vertical space. Mm. And Wang, Kerwala, and Dai, they really stress this point. No matter what kind of overhead system you're using, you have to make sure there's enough room for the pantograph.
The pantograph, just a reminder for our listeners.
Yeah, that's that arm on the top of the train that actually connects with the overhead lines to draw the power.
Right, right. So it's not just about the train and its juice. The tunnel itself has all this other critical infrastructure, right? Mm-hmm. Utilities, walkways, things like that. All that has to factor into where the track ends up, doesn't it?
Absolutely. It's like a whole hidden world down there. You need space for all sorts of things. Those combined services routes, which carry, you know, power cables, signaling wires, communication lines, all bundled together. Then a drainage, super important to keep the water out. And walkways, you got to have those for emergency evacuations and for maintenance crews to do their thing. The paper points out that the size of these things and the access you need to them, they can directly affect how far away from the tunnel central line the track needs to be.
Can you give us an example?
Sure. Say you need a really wide emergency walkway along one side of the track. Well, that's going to push the track further away from that tunnel wall. It's all connected.
Makes sense. Okay, so we've got all these competing demands for space. How do the experts figure out, like, the perfect spot for the track within the tunnel? The paper talks about something called the tunnel and track positioning methodology. Sounds kind of complicated. Can you give us a simplified version of what's going on there?
Basically a design process, and it's iterative, meaning it goes through multiple rounds of refinement. Usually starts with a basic layout for the track based on how the railway needs to function. Things like speed, stopping distances, where the stations are, all that. Once you've got that initial alignment, then the engineers start layering on all those spatial constraints we've been talking about. The kinematic envelope of the trains, the safety clearances, the space for the track form, the overhead lines, utilities, walkways, the whole shebang. And then, using all that, they calculate how far off the tunnel center line the track needs to be, both vertically and horizontally. And here's the kicker. This isn't just a straight line calculation. When you get into curves, it gets a lot more complex. You have to account for cant, which is the banking of the track. That throws another wrench into the whole thing.
Ah, so that's where it gets really tricky. And the paper actually gives us a couple of formulas for convex offset and concave offset when you're dealing with curved track. And it throws in these terms like center throw and end throw. It definitely sounds like a very, very precise dance of geometry happening here.
Oh, it is.
And speaking of geometry, can you explain what center throw is in, like, a real-world scenario? When does that become super important to get right?
Okay, picture this. A train going around a tight curve. Because the train has length, the middle of the train is going to swing out a bit further from the track center line than the ends. That's your center throw. Now, if you've got a walkway or some utilities running along the inside of that curve, you absolutely have to calculate that outward swing accurately. Otherwise, boom, you've got a potential collision, especially when you factor in that kinematic envelope. It's the same idea with end throw, which is the overhang at the front and back of the train as it enters and exits a curve.
Right. You got to make sure the train doesn't clip anything as it goes around.
Precisely.
It all sounds incredibly detailed and probably pretty time-consuming to figure out manually.
It can be, yeah.
But here's where it gets, as the paper says, really interesting. We're entering the world of automation. The authors talk about using software, particularly a program called Dynamo, to handle these complex calculations and even generate 3D models of the tunnel. This shift to automation, it seems like a pretty big deal.
It is. It's a game changer. And Wang, Kirawalla, and Dai, they do a great job of outlining the benefits. First off, it drastically cuts down on human error. When you're dealing with all these variables and formulas, it's really easy to make a mistake. But with the software, you reduce that risk significantly. Second, it speeds things up. Engineers can try out different design options and make changes much faster than they could if they were doing everything by hand. And that scalability, that speed, it's vital for large, complex projects.
So it's like having a superpowered calculator that can also visualize the tunnel in 3D.
Exactly.
And this efficiency ultimately means lower design costs, right?
Yes, and you get a more robust, more optimized final design.
So instead of, hunkering down with calculators and spreadsheets, the engineers can focus on those higher-level design choices, playing around with different scenarios, and really finding the absolute best solution.
Exactly. And the paper goes even further, looking ahead to potential future developments, like even tighter integration between different software platforms, full automation of the track alignment generation, going beyond just basic straight lines and curves.
That sounds interesting.
And maybe the most exciting thing, they talk about developing a digital twin of the whole tunnel infrastructure.
Okay, so we've got to talk about this digital twin idea. What exactly does that mean in this context, and how do you see it being used in the future?
It's like having a virtual replica, a complete copy of the tunnel and all its components. And you can use it throughout the entire life of the tunnel, from construction all the way to maintenance. Imagine being able to simulate the construction process before you even break ground. You could identify potential problems or clashes in the virtual world before they become real-world
That's
headaches.
pretty amazing.
And for maintenance, it would be revolutionary. You'd have a precise record of every single component, its condition, its maintenance history, so you could plan inspections and repairs much more proactively and efficiently.
Okay, so I'm getting the sense that this digital twin idea has the potential to really change how we think about designing, building, and maintaining these systems.
It really does.
The paper also briefly touches on the idea of exploring alternative methods for setting out the track. It seems like even some of the most fundamental practices in railway engineering are being re-examined through this lens of efficiency and optimization.
Yeah, they specifically mentioned the standard practice of applying CANT, that track banking we talked about the low rail. They suggest that maybe, especially as we use more ballastless track, there might be other points of rotation that would lead to better space optimization. But they're cautious, and rightly so. This would need a very careful case-by-case evaluation.
So it's like we're not throwing out the old rule book, but we're definitely not afraid to question it either. Well, I got to say, this deep dive into the, seemingly very specific world of track and tunnel central lines has really given me a new appreciation for the sheer complexity and precision that goes into designing these underground rail systems. It's mind-boggling how many factors have to be perfectly balanced just to make sure everything fits and functions safely and efficiently.
And what's really fascinating is that this seemingly like hyper-focused technical challenge actually requires this big picture understanding of the whole rail system, from how the train moves to all the different systems within the tunnel itself. And technology, it's playing an increasingly important role in helping us find those optimal solutions.
Yeah, massive shout out to Eric Wang, Sanaya Kerawala, and Wilson Dai for their work on this paper. For our listeners, I hope this deep dive has given you a glimpse into this hidden world, this critical, often unseen aspect of how our cities work. Maybe next time you're on an underground train, you'll pause for a second and think about all the incredible engineering that went into making that journey possible. This deep dive was based on the work of Eric Wang, Sanaya Kerawala, and Wilson Dai from their paper, Relationship Between Track and Tunnel Central Lines. Trackside Talks will be back with another deep dive soon. Until then, keep those questions coming and stay curious.